Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 8, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Kajaniya Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
We have two new folks tonight, and just to emphasize this is an important point, that everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of something called dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. He awakened to that idea of dependent origination, which states from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing stress and disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences occur. And then again, his very first teaching was to teach these Four Noble Truths, called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Which briefly says that as a result of this basic ignorance, confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering arises because of this. That's the first noble truth, known as dukkha occurs, because of the second noble truth, which that states craving for and clinging to a misunderstanding of what a self is in relation to its environment results in that suffering. Is that simple enough and direct enough? Does it make sense? Okay. The third noble truth is, I think, one of the most important ones, even though they're equally important, is that cessation of that ignorance is possible. It's a way to gain understanding. And it's possible for any human being. We don't need any special characteristics or special dispensations from disincarnate beings. We don't have to do any special rituals to prove our worth towards awakening. The Buddha taught the only thing we need to do is to develop and integrate the Eightfold Path as the path of liberation from those wrong views. So again, everything the Buddha taught was to recognize and abandon ignorance of the way things actually are, including this sutta tonight. It may seem a little bit difficult to understand why I'm even teaching this until you develop a little bit more of a broader understanding of this. But that's why we have our classes here. And we are starting Saturday and Tuesday, the same class each day, something called the Truth of Happiness Dhamma Study that we do once a year. And that's a 12-week course where we establish in a very broad and fundamental way what the Buddha taught. So if you're interested, I would really encourage you to take that with us. And if you're just coming back, it'd be great too. This sutta... let me just go back just a little bit. 2 weeks ago, we taught and discussed the Dhatuvabhanga Sutta, where the Buddha describes the completely impersonal and ordinary nature of a human being, of a person. There's nothing extraordinary. And when you look at that, it's described as the six properties that make up a person. There is nothing that we should take personal or think that it is extraordinary. The four elements of earth, wind, water, and fire. The fifth element is space, and the sixth element is the thinking that is part of that process. There's nothing personal about any of that. That's the Buddha's description, an awakened human being, of what constitutes a person. Last week's sutta is a sutta where the Buddha describes his Dhamma, and the translated word is miracle, meaning it is the extraordinary nature of what he taught, and that the true miracle of it is to gain an understanding of the nature of suffering resulting from a misunderstanding of self. In other words, the miracle of the Dhamma is really simply understanding what constitutes a person in reality, in relation to the world around us. And that points us to the very specific insight that the Buddha taught. There's the modern Buddhist movement of insight is a very broad application that doesn't get to the heart of the matter. The Buddha taught insight in a very specific way, insight into the impermanence of all things, the misunderstanding of self, the not-self characteristic known as anatta, and the resulting suffering. So everything the Buddha teaches is to gain an understanding of those three things, which are really can be seen as a package of dukkha because of that misunderstanding. This sutta is called the Kajaniya Sutta. The subtitle is Freedom from Affliction, and the affliction relates directly to this misunderstanding of self or the not-self characteristic. The Buddha described the personal ongoing experience of suffering in the world as five clinging aggregates: form, this physical form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. Now remember, this is not some grand cosmic consciousness. It's ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. All right, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. I won't get too deep into that, but that relates directly to dependent origination. Okay. Does everybody understand where I am so far, even the two new folks? Does it make a little bit of sense anyway?
Yeah.
Okay, good. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Savatthi. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, any Dhamma practitioner who directs their thinking to past lives are only recollecting one or all of those five aggregates that I just mentioned. Now, the Buddha is talking about a very specific subject of recollecting past lives. And one of the reasons why he's doing that, well, the reason why he's doing that during his time, is that the recollection of past lives, or the seeking to establish yourself in past lives, was often taught as some type of a spiritual practice. In other words, if you could do it, if you could remember who you were in these numerous past lives, that was a sign that you were gaining some type of spiritual understanding. That's still taught in much of modern Buddhism today. It was taught to me that I would know that I'm gaining some kind of understanding when I could recollect my manifold past lives. And it wasn't until I came to what the Buddha actually taught to realize that, as far as that's concerned, that's just more distraction. And that's what he's teaching here. That seeking to establish yourself in any speculative realm, past or future, whether it's trying to conjure up past lives or to manipulate what you might be in the future, is simply rooted in fabrications, a fabricated view, a corrupted view of who you are in relation to the world. And it's, when you look at it closely, it's a way of escaping who I am right now, because who I am right now is inadequate in some way. There's something lacking. But in the past, I was this and that. And if I do a certain number of things in the future, I can be so much better than I am now. Do you see how that takes you out of what's occurring right now? That really is an essential part of the Buddha's teaching. Ultimately, what the Buddha's teaching is a level of refined mindfulness that unites the mind in the body, right here, right now, as life occurs, without the need for anything to be any different than it is. Because as soon as I decide that something is inadequate or I am inadequate in relation to the world, I'm out of my body. I'm confused, I'm deluded, and suffering is going to follow. Is that clear? So that really is the essence of what the Buddha is teaching and what he's referring to. It's not just this idea of past lives. It's any speculative application of yourself. And even an idealized view of yourself is a speculation. In other words, I don't know why I've been using this lately, that I think of myself as the world's best baker. And I'm using something kind of silly and common, but once I decided that I have to be the world's best baker, everything I'm doing now is focused on that. And I'm out of simply being, living a life. My whole life is wrapped around proving that to myself and everyone around me. And whenever I decide on this idealized view of myself, I am compelled to promote it and defend it. Another example that I've used is someone tells me that eating mushrooms is good for my health. And it probably is, unless you're eating the wrong mushrooms. But I buy into it. And so then every moment in my life, or most moments in my life, are now focused on where can I get the best mushrooms to fix this self that needs them, rather than just enjoying mushrooms. Do you see the difference? It's subtle. The action is still the same. But one, I'm trying to fix myself, and I'm trying to establish myself as a good mushroom eater or a good baker or a good bus driver or something else, whatever it might be, rather than simply being this ordinary person without any attachments to it. That's where peace and happiness abide. Okay. I'm skipping over some of my commentary. The Buddha then asks the question, which five? When recollecting, I was one with such a form in the past, one is only recollecting form, that first part of the five clinging aggregates. In other words, when recollecting that I was a king of England in the past life, even if I was somehow, even if that was true, no way of knowing it, it's only speculation, I'm only recollecting form. the fact that that form in my imagination, or maybe in some past reality, that I actually was the King of England, is simply a fabrication of overimportance of what I was. Because what I was just a form that happened, maybe happened to have such a life. But the problem with it is now I'm projecting myself into the past. And who knows? And it's not just that one life. It's any level of speculation in this, in the past life or a future life, or even in this life in a non-physical realm. When recollecting I was one with such a feeling in the past, one is only recollecting feeling. And that's important whether we're thinking about a past life or yesterday or 5 minutes ago. How often do we use feelings to describe ourselves, to make ourselves real? I had a bad day. Rather than just recognizing that it was a progression of one feeling after another feeling that is only manifesting in this moment because of what the way I'm holding it in mind. In other words, it was a possibly disappointing or unsatisfying experience, but it's gone. But by me attaching to myself to that experience, that it should have been different than it was, and think about that for a moment, it can't be, can it? Nothing can be different than what is actually occurring because it's already occurred. But by me holding in mind, I had a bad day, I'm bringing that into the present moment, but I'm stuck, my mind is stuck in the past. What does that really mean? I'm out of my body. I'm not seeing things in reality. If I understand what the Buddha taught, rooted in the deep concentration developed in meditation and the refined mindfulness that he taught, I'll simply see myself as this is what's occurring. And even if the thought in my mind is I had a bad day, I'll be able to practice restraint and realize that that's not me because I've gained a certain level of understanding. That's what the Buddha teaches, is restraint. And so I don't need to drag anything around with me anymore. There's great freedom in developing the Eightfold Path because of that. And again, it's not just recollecting past lives from millions of years ago. It's dragging around 5 minutes ago with me because it's no longer occurring, is it? There's simply me present in my body. And what develops from that type of refined mindfulness is a deep appreciation and great meaning to each and every moment that we have in our lives, no matter what's occurring. Whether it's something that we hope would not occur, but it is, or even something that might bring great excitement, we stay level-headed. The word that's often used is mind of equanimity, no matter what's occurring. We have deep appreciation for what's occurring simply because it's occurring, not because it's occurring to me or for my benefit. That's when speculation gets in trouble. When recollecting, I was one with perceptions in the past. One is only recollecting perceptions, again, relating to the five clinging aggregates. When recollecting, I was one with such fabrication in the past. One is only recollecting fabrications. It's not my fabrications. When recollecting, I was one with such a consciousness in the past. One is only recollecting consciousness. And you'll see why this is important as I go along. But it's in this moment that we're recollecting and being mindful of, this is a completely impersonal experience that's only made personal by my ignorance of the way things are. The Buddha asked the question again, why is the form aggregate called form? Because it is afflicted. Form is afflicted with cold, heat, hunger, thirst, wind, sun, bugs, and reptiles. So again, these aren't absolute statements. What the Buddha is saying is by self-identifying with the form, when a bug bites me, the bug is biting me. It's not biting the form. And I can get into all kinds of things like, why do I have to suffer? Why are the bugs biting me and not you? Or at least, why aren't they biting you more than me? It's the self-identification that causes the ongoing suffering, rather than being bitten by a bug or whatever it might be, having a cold day, but finally finding shelter. It's no longer a personal experience. It's no longer a distraction. You're no longer making a self out of something that doesn't describe a self. You're no longer rooted in that confusion and ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I'm going to go through these quickly here. Why is the feeling aggregate called feeling? Because it feels. It's only an aggregate when I attach myself to it, when I'm just using my feelings to describe who I am, what my worth is, how I'm doing in the world, how I might be doing with other people in the world, all based on feeling, when those feelings are rooted in something completely impersonal. Why is a perception aggregate called perception? Because it perceives. It perceives blue, yellow, red, white, meaning it discerns things that it prefers to have. Why is a fabrication called fabrication? Because it fabricates. It fabricates what is experienced as form, as feelings, as perceptions, as consciousness. It fabricates fabrications. Do you see the complete feedback loop that you get stuck in then once you start fabrication? I should say that, go a little bit further on dependent origination. Dependent origination states that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths as a requisite condition come fabrications. From fabrications comes consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in what? A fabricated or corrupted view that arises because of this initial ignorance. Excuse me. So, from an initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths, a mind can only fabricate what its experience and its response to that experience. Why? Because it's rooted in ignorance. It's not seeing life clearly in relation to the impermanence of all things, a true understanding of what a person is and that resulting suffering. It fabricates. And what does it fabricate? It fabricates fabrications. In other words, once you're stuck in that fabricated life rooted in ignorance, unless something happens to intervene, to break up those fabrications by recognizing them as such, you're prone to continue to fabricate. Is that clear? So when the Buddha awakened, he sat again in meditation off and on for another couple of weeks, trying to decide, is it possible to teach this profound understanding that he has, knowing the problem of a mind that is ignorant will continue to ignore its own ignorance. One of the most remarkable things that I've learned from this fortunate seat that I have is the very powerful but subtle strategies that we all employ to continue to ignore our own ignorance. And they all seem reasonable. Why? Because I'm thinking it. I mean, that's the sole qualification. And then we'll find other people that are so afflicted, and they'll help us continue to confirm our own ignorance. And that's just human nature. That's what we do. And so the Buddha developed an eightfold path and no other path. So we have a framework and the guidance to recognize and abandon fabrications and their underlying ignorance. It's the sole purpose of the Eightfold Path. And that's why it works, because it's focused on just that one thing and just that one methodology of deepening concentration and developing refined mindfulness. Fabrications fabricate. And why is a consciousness aggregate called consciousness? Because it cognizes. In other words, the Buddha is describing something that we want to make special. Like often, especially those in modern spirituality, will hear the word consciousness and will immediately go, I bet you most of us have done this at least once or twice, will immediately go, well, consciousness is a grand cosmic type of consciousness, isn't it? And we all want to be part of that one great consciousness. Maybe that's true, but it's not something the Buddha teaches. In fact, if we believe that, we have to recognize it and abandon it as far as our Dhamma practice. Because consciousness only cognizes. And when it cognizes from a mind rooted in fabrication, what is it doing? It's reinforcing those fabrications. It's fooling itself. I think it's in the Truth of Happiness book that I mentioned that. It's like a magician's trick, but we're the magicians. We're playing this trick on ourselves because we're ignoring our own ignorance. As far as the Four Noble Truths, you know, I should say that too. I'm not saying, and the Buddha's not saying, that as human beings we're just simply ignorant. It's a very specific ignorance. It's ignorance of these Four Noble Truths. Why is the aggregate called the consciousness aggregate? Because it cognizes. It cognizes sour, sweet, bitter, pungent, salty, or bland. All of those things that the Buddha's using are things that I prefer. I like salty foods. I don't like bland foods. These are sensual stimulation that reinforces eye-making. It reinforces ignorance.
He only uses those that basically taste things in this specific setting, because there are other things that we cognize.
Oh yeah, he's just making a quick example in this. And when the Buddha talks about the six sense bases are five physical senses and the sixth sense of consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance, that is interpreting our experience through those five senses, he places a consciousness on each one of the senses. In other words, the eye has its own consciousness. Why? Because something comes through my vision and I start interpreting it based on my own view of myself in relation to the world. In other words, if my view is fabricated, what's coming through my senses, through my eye consciousness, will be interpreted in that manner through a self-referential view. A good example of that is the arbitrariness of what we consider beautiful. One person thinks this is beautiful, another person thinks something completely opposite is beautiful. Well, how can that be? It's because they're seeing things from their own perspective. And each one of our consciousnesses has the same thing. The ear consciousness. Some people love opera, some people can't get enough of rap. You know, it's all the same. It's all noise, isn't it? But because of our perceptions and our fabricated view, we're going to experience things differently and make choices as to what I like. And some people will take those choices to an extreme that will create conflict over that. Or will at least see people as less than us, because how can anybody like opera when rap is all, by the way, I don't listen to rap too much. When rap is all there is, or when, you know, the Beatles are all, you know, anybody else. Do you see the point that I'm making is because it's my preference. Well, what?
Bonnie said, well, there is the
Beatles. Because it's my preference. You know, look at the conflicts in the world. They're all based on that. What I think is right, everybody else is wrong. We were talking a little bit about the Crusades and how people do things in the name of religion and excuse it away because God wants them to do it. That's all part of this mind rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are. Friends, a well-instructed Dhamma practitioner understands, I am now being afflicted by form. In the past, I was afflicted by form, and if I delight in future form, I will likewise be afflicted with future form. A wise Dhamma practitioner understands that it is by self-identifying with what's occurring, rooted in this idea of preferential and cognizable choices, I'm afflicting myself. This isn't something that is just occurring. It's not a happenstance of birth or anything else. It's not punishment for some poor behavior in the past. It's simply a lack of understanding. Understanding, they become disenchanted with past and future form. Understanding, we become disenchanted. So my mind, because I am now disenchanted, the word enchantment is so applicable, because what it really means is I am enchanted with my own thoughts of myself and what I might become in the future.
So John, and, is understanding right view?
Pardon me?
Understanding right view?
Yes, this is, yeah. Enchantment means that I am mesmerized. I've hypnotized myself to thinking that there's some value in speculating an existence in the past as something, no matter what it was. I mean, I mentioned the King of England, but it could be anything, whatever I might think I was in the past. Or if I do certain things, I'll get some kind of reward and I will be this in the future. That's an affliction. It causes pain now, because I've now lost my mind. My mind isn't united with my body. It's another word that could be applied to it, because it's such a common word today, is mindless mindfulness. Because mindfulness means to recollect or hold in mind. We can do that with anything, including the idea that I should do certain rituals or certain practices or gain certain understandings. So in the next moment or the next lifetime, I'm going to be better than I am right now. How can you improve on something that is completely impersonal? Unless you're enchanted by it. By developing disenchantment with who and what we are in this moment, we won't speculate, we won't create experiences to establish ourselves in non-physical forms, really only in our minds, in our imagination. Let me go back to the beginning of that. Understanding, they become disenchanted with past and future form. They are now practicing the Dhamma to become disenchanted and dispassionate with present form. So before we can really get to the begin to unite the mind and the body, where all understanding can take place, we have to get our heads and our minds out of the past and the future speculative establishments. Is that clear? When we can do that, now we can start dealing with what's actually occurring. And how do we do that? How does the Eightfold Path relate directly to this? The Buddha taught a very specific meditation practice as the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, called right meditation, for the sole purpose of deepening concentration and for nothing else. He didn't teach meditation to analyze or attempt to establish itself in other realms, excuse me, or really even to seek insight into things, to develop concentration. And why is that? Because a mind that is well concentrated is present. A mind that is distracted in any way is not. It's really that simple. And a mind that is concentrated enough, and it doesn't take superhuman effort, we all established a level of concentration tonight, a mind that has a measure of concentration can then develop the refined mindfulness that allows us to see things clearly as they really are, to see reality. That's where the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path come in. Okay. Disenchanted and dispassionate with present form, they are now practicing the Dhamma to develop cessation from clinging even to this present form, which is really the only place that true understanding can take place, in this present moment. To recognize that in this moment, even though I thought I was clinging to this form in the past or clinging to a future form, the reality of it is, of the five clinging aggregates, is in this moment I'm clinging to this form as me. And that's what allows for that speculative self-establishment in non-physical realms. And even that, to be clear, when I'm self-identifying that this is the form, this is me, this is what I am, I'm really out of my body anyway, and that's a little bit too confusing to talk about it, so I won't. But anyway, it becomes a little more clear here. Furthermore, this well-instructed Dhamma practitioner understands, I am now being afflicted by feelings, by perceptions, and by fabrications, and by consciousness. So what is it, now that we've brought our mind into what's occurring, we can recognize that it's in my life as my life occurs that I am afflicting myself by self-identifying with my feelings and with my perceptions and with my fabrications. Remember, all of those are fabricated fabrications. And how can they not be an affliction? An affliction is anything that is distracting or disappointing, unsatisfactory, or outright painful. And it all follows from this consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I am now being afflicted by feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. In the past, I was also afflicted by feelings, by perceptions, by fabrications, and by consciousness. And if I delight in future feelings, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness, I will likewise be afflicted with future feelings, perceptions, fabrications, excuse me, and consciousness. So that idea of if I do anything, you know, in certain religions, it's simply a following a moral code, and in death I'll get my reward. The most prevalent form of modern Buddhism teaches that a very specific chant, and if you chant this chant continuously, and if that chant is on your lips when you die, you'll immediately be transported to this Buddhist heaven, often called Tulsita Buddhist heaven, where forever and ever you'll be taken care of by Abhidhamma Buddha. It sounds great, doesn't it? And it was so appealing to me that I tried it for about 27 minutes, and I got tired of the chant. But and I'm not trying to be funny about that. The point I'm trying to make is that's just another speculative way of living your life. And the way that I see that now is you have just lost your entire life, because your entire life was predicated on doing something that you got a reward from in the future. The Buddha taught, and I can't get into all those suttas where he explained his own understanding of this, but he taught that the most profound experience that any human being can have is to actually be present for their life as their life unfolds. Think about that. Mm-hmm. It is pretty profound, isn't it? To actually be present, to be mindfully present, to be meaningfully mindfully present in your life as your life occurs, without the need for it to be any different, no matter what occurs, because you understand this is what life is. Not this is what is happening to me. This is what life is. This is what having a human life is. The understanding, that profound understanding, and the peace that comes along with that, the lack of conflict in our minds and the lack of conflict that we'll then see in the world around us is the ultimate peace. And it doesn't mean that we won't be skillfully motivated towards wise and compassionate behavior, but the qualifier there is the wise part of that compassionate behavior. We'll be acting from a position of great wisdom rather than just reacting to what we think, what we speculate compassion should be. And we talked about that earlier. That's led to incredible suffering in the world. You gonna say something, Rob?
No.
Okay. Understanding, they become disenchanted with past and future feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. They are now practicing the Dhamma to become disenchanted and dispassionate with present feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. That's why we're practicing it, to become dispassionate about this ongoing eye-making. They are now practicing the Dhamma to develop cessation from clinging to present feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. What do you think, friends? Is form permanent or impermanent? Are feelings, perceptions, fabrications, consciousness permanent or impermanent? They reply, great teacher, they are all impermanent. And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful? What is impermanent is always stressful, great teacher. Friends, is it fitting to self-identify with what is impermanent and stressful, always subject to change and uncertainty, as this is me, this is mine, this is what I am? Great teacher, it is not fitting to self-identify with what is impermanent and stressful, always subject to change and uncertainty, as this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. The Buddha is just reinforcing that notion that this is self-identification rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's the cause of all this suffering. Friends, it is known by the wise that any form whatsoever that is past, present, or future, any form that is internal or external, external means any speculative self-establishment, any form that is obvious or subtle, any form that is common or sublime, any form near or far, should always be seen through right view as this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Furthermore, any feelings, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness whatsoever, past, present, or future, internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or sublime, near or far, should always be seen through right view. Right view, by the way, is the first factor of the Eightfold Path, and it's the culmination of the path. Should be seen as right view as this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Complete disenchantment and dispassionate response to former eye-making. Skip over some of my commentary. This, friends, is called a Dhamma practitioner who diminishes rather than embellishes. Diminishes rather than embellishes what? Eye-making. Further establishment of a self in speculative realms. And a speculative realm, again, is any type of imaginary self-establishment. This, friends, is called a Dhamma practitioner who diminishes rather than embellishes, who abandons rather than clings, abandons fabricated views, wrong views, who discards rather than acquires, who scatters and does not pile up. The wise Dhamma practitioner diminishes form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than embellish these aggregates. And those are the aggregates that we use to embellish ourselves constantly. So it really is a completely peaceful but contradictory way of living our life, meaning the way that we're conditioned to think we should. We think that life should be and is a continual struggle to keep a self established, when the Buddha teaches that need to do that is rooted in wrong views, that it can't possibly be done because all things are impermanent, so why try? Because it just leads to speculation. We grasp at ways of establishing the self in each and every thought, word, and idea that occurs. And that causes this underlying stress that medical science is finally recognizing is the underlying cause of most diseases. And the underlying cause is that need for constantly establishing yourself, choosing what's good for me and what's bad for me, what I like, what I don't like, what I hope doesn't occur, what I hope wouldn't have occurred. It's all part of this, rather than simply being present with what's occurring. The wise Dharma practitioner abandons form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than cling to those aggregates. The wise Dharma practitioner discards form, feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than acquire these aggregates. And most of us spend our whole life acquiring more things. We think that's kind of like the, what's that, that joke saying? Those that have the most toys at the end win. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what most of us do, whether we're doing at a compulsive level or just thinking we need to do it to survive. But we keep piling up stuff and using that stuff to describe ourselves, whether we want to or not, whether we do it at an extreme level like some people. Or what most people do, though, we describe ourselves to ourselves or create a creative view of ourselves based on what we have. We all do, you know. When what we have is nice, but we if we use it to describe ourselves, we're always creating a situation where we're going to be disappointed or there's always going to be fear. You know, in the Mula Sutta, where there's desire, there's fear. The wise Dharma practitioner scatters form, feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than pile up these aggregates. Understanding impermanence with regards to these aggregates, the well-instructed Dharma practitioner grows disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perceptions, and they grow disenchanted with consciousness. And again, it doesn't mean we won't have feelings or perceptions or thinking. We're just disenchanted. We're not using them to continue our enchantment, our ignorance of the way things truly are. Excuse me. When disenchanted, they become dispassionate. With dispassion established, there is release from clinging to wrong views, ignorant of Four Noble Truths. We're finally able to let go of those views that are keeping us in bondage to suffering. Released, they now know they are released. Why that's an important line is there's no speculation in the Buddha's Dhamma. We know it's working. And we know when we've released ourselves from all views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. It's a direct, visceral experience. And we've all talked about that, of developing that, developing an ever-deepening level of concentration. It's important to recognize that as part of our Dhamma practice, that it's actually working. Because when we get to that point where we've let go of all views ignorant of Four Noble Truths, we will know it. How will we know it? Because we'll be present to see it. We'll be in our bodies.
Even when we release ourselves from certain clingings,
yep.
Right away you know.
Oh. You know, and it very, very rarely.
Likeness come up.
Once we've abandoned some clinging view, clinging to some type of object, event, view, or idea, it very rarely reoccurs, does it?
Yeah.
We've left it behind.
You see it coming, and you step aside.
And that's exactly what the Buddha is talking about. We can diminish the effects of ignorance. That's what the sutta, a theme of this, is actually diminishing the conditioned mind that we've developed on our own, by the way. We're responsible for the level of our conditioned mind. The environment we live in does a great deal of that conditioning, but it's our mind that has become conditioned. It's our mind to decondition it or to become disenchanted with our conditioned mind. They know that birth has ended. I should qualify that too. The Buddha is not talking about a future birth. He's talking about that when we develop this type of understanding, we will no longer give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance and prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing stress and suffering. They know that birth has ended. A life well integrated with the heartwood. The heartwood is the Buddha uses the word heartwood, or I do. I'm always referring to the Eightfold Path. The life well integrated with the heartwood has been fulfilled. The task is complete. They know that there will be no further entanglements with the world. This, friends, is a Dhamma practitioner who neither diminishes nor embellishes form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness, but who is now established in the Dhamma, having abandoned identifying with those aggregates. What that means is when you go from a mind rooted in ignorance to a mind settled in wisdom, you look just the same. Most people won't be able to tell the difference. And even your actions, by and large, will be the same, unless you were, you know, some type of serial killer. That will likely change. Well, it will change. And even your own thoughts in relation to yourself will be the same, except there won't be any self-reference in those thoughts. In other words, you still might enjoy a nice piece of chocolate cake, but there's no self-identifying with it. You might very well be the world's greatest baker, but you won't need everybody else to tell you that to reassure you. You just will be, or whatever else you're choosing in your life. But most importantly, you won't need to be any different than what you are, because you'll know that that's what you are. There's nothing to fix. There's nothing to aspire to. There's nothing to acquire. And at that point, there's nothing to take away. You're simply pure, bright consciousness, fully engaged, fully mindfully engaged with life as life occurs. Not a bad deal.
I like that last part of that paragraph where you say there are no further entanglements with the world.
Yeah.
Because the standard way of saying that is, I'm no longer...
nothing further for this world.
Nothing further for this world. That really really puts a nice emphasis on it's the entanglements of the world that you are leaving behind, not the world itself.
Yes, but most of the translations from the Pali finish that, and this is a saying that the Buddha uses often, describing an awakening, that it's that there is nothing further for this world. But what the Buddha's entire point of his teaching is to disentangle or uncling these aggregates, and so disentangle ourselves from clinging to the people and events of the world to describe ourselves. We're no longer disentangled with the world. So some people, when they first hear that, and start getting an idea, the implication of the Buddha's Dhamma, it feels like annihilation. But what the Buddha is teaching is that we don't need to be entangled in the world. In fact, it's really just the opposite. If we want to be fully mindful of our life, if we want to have a fully mindful life, we have to be disentangled from the world. Because as we're entangled with the world and what's occurring around us is always self-identified with. And so it always has to be different in some way. That we have to have more of what we're getting or less. Or the predominant feeling among most human beings is we're removed from the world because we're out of our body. So we have this generally ambiguous feeling about what's occurring. That's not good. It means that we're disjoined from our body when we're like that. The Buddha teaches to be disentangled from the world, and the paradox of that saying and that achievement is that we are fully involved in the world for the first time. Why? Because we don't need it to be any different. We're in our bodies, or our mind united with its body. This, friends, is a Dhamma practitioner who neither clings to nor abandons form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness, but who is now established in the Dhamma, having abandoned these aggregates. Skip ahead a little bit. This, friends, is a Dhamma practitioner who neither acquires nor discards form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness, but who is now established in the Dhamma, having discarded these aggregates. This, friends, is a Dhamma practitioner who neither piles up nor scatters form, feelings, perceptions, or consciousness, but who is now established in the Dhamma, having scattered these aggregates. Friends, I declare, it is from diminishing, abandoning, discarding and scattering these aggregates that one is established in the Dhamma, a wise Dhamma practitioner free of affliction. Friends, one who has released their mind from all wrong views is never afflicted again by speculation. This one is established in right view. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you. There's a terrific amount of information there. You got to go?
Yes.
I'm so glad to see you.
Kids okay. Good
to great see to see you again, Kilda. Take care, Christine.
Very nice. Good
to see you. Happy New Year.
Yes.
For those that are new, this might be a little bit, I know it's out of context because you haven't heard it before, but understand it is in an underlying or most important theme of the Dhamma is recognizing self-referential views and how we use that to continue creating stress in our lives. When we let go of self-referential views, we are free of stress. And that's really what this Eightfold Path and the meditation practice is all about. So let's go around and see what you have to say. Good to see you, Matt.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody here. Glad to see some new faces. I don't have a lot to add, other than, you know, we all have to look into our own lives and see where, our craving, our passion, our desire, how these things keep us entangled, you know, and make us stressed. We have to look at that, and that's part of what this practice is. So,
thank you. Let me ask Mary and Jane if they have anything. I'll unmute your mics. I think I unmuted you, Jane, and there's Mary. So, Mary, how are you tonight?
Hi. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Mary.
it's a good sutta, and I really like what Matt just said. And something that was said on Saturday about when there's conflict, there's ignorance. Yep. And that's a real easy way for us to recognize in our professional lives and our personal lives when we're out of sync and we're entangled with the world. Yeah. So this is good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Yeah, whenever there's a disturbance in our mind, we know that we're taking life personally. We can simply remind ourselves that this is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. Take a breath and move on to the next moment. So, Jane, how are you tonight?
I'm fine, thank you.
I'm glad you could join us.
This applied to me a lot because prior to my Dhamma practice, I was living most of my life in the past, wanting things from the past that I didn't have, very stressed, very unhappy. And since I started my Dhamma practice, I realized that, you know, the impermanence, and I'm finding more times where I'm in the present, and I'm finding peace.
Isn't that remarkable? Yeah.
Thank you.
And peace can only be found here. It can't be found in the past or the future, can it?
No.
Thank you, Jane. I'm glad you joined us tonight. Lorna, good to see you. Good evening.
Good evening. I think I've seen tonight more than ever that when we're hard on ourselves, we're using five clinging aggregates to do that.
Wow, yeah.
And that's how we do it. And we often say that when we look at dependent origination, that if you can see one of the links of the chain of dependent origination, if you can see one of the links, break that apart and understand it, you can't, or the other links in the chain fall apart too. I think you could almost say that about the five clinging aggregates as well, that if you could really penetrate and see through one of those five clinging aggregates, that we would not be hard on ourselves, because we're breaking the chain that we are stuck in, that cycle. When we are hard on ourselves, wanting ourselves to be different than how we are, or wanting life to be different than it is, and da 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 da, and that's the five clinging aggregates, is actually how we're doing it.
So you
can look at it that way.
That's the right way to look at it. The five clinging aggregates are anatta. They're also can be seen as karma, because that's what's unfolding as a result of clinging these aggregates together to describe a self. And what Lorna's referring to as breaking the chain, the dependent origination is often referred to as the 12-link chain of dependencies, starting in ignorance that ends in suffering. And so whenever you, just like any chain, once you break one link, the whole chain falls apart. And that's really a good way of looking at it. Once we recognize any one of these things, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, or consciousness, as not me, the whole ball of wax falls apart. Or, you know, another more elegant way of saying it is we awaken to what's truly here, because we've let go of that veil of ignorance that's blocking reality. And as the Buddha describes that too, it's not something that's impenetrable. It's like foam on the water. There's nothing really there except wrong mindfulness holds it there. Mm-hmm. We keep it there from self-referential view. Thank you.
Thank you.
Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. For me, you know, the main message is get over yourself.
That's a good way of putting it.
And that, for me, one of the simplest and most effective tools I use when I get caught in dependent origination or form, feeling, perception is to first recognize it and then smile, like, gotcha, you know, and just from that point, you know, you realize that you've just empowered yourself to let it all go and be present and not carry that baggage with you, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And what is, there's no point in saying, why me? There's no answer to that, whatever it is. And, you know, just we have this knowledge now that we don't have to carry this baggage. We don't have to pick up these loads. We don't have to stuff our pockets with anxiety. That really what is. And that's really all there is to it.
Yeah, it is.
You know, just don't get stuck. That's, yep. You know,
don't get entangled.
Don't get entangled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a friend who just lost her mother, and she was very, very close to her and is having a really hard time accepting it, feeling guilty because she had the flu and couldn't spend her last few days with her, finding all sorts of reasons to be even more heartbroken about it. And you can't just jump in and say, you know, life is impermanent, of course she died, we're all impermanent, you know, you just can't begin it like that. But in gentle ways you can bring a sense of peace to someone as they're going through that. Sometimes it's just listening to them, and as they're speaking, sometimes that starts to even unravel where they are, you know, when they hear their words, and you can gently bring other things into it. But I just find that what we do here is so applicable in so many ways, you know, in your own life, in how you interact with others. You know, you said from the outside, nobody will know that you're different, but I sort of feel like there is a different radiance about people who are at peace.
There are.
You know, that's...
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, and it's... I think when some people seem to always project themselves into stressful situations, like everything's an emergency, or everything's a crisis, or everything's a big deal, and they're so familiar with that anxious energy, and when you're with them and you're just not responding, it's sort of like a top, you know, it spins. The more it spins, the more out of control it gets until it just stops. And so sometimes you just being there in a calmer way allows them to get to that point of exhaustion. And then maybe that's when the opening is to just say one simple thing that gives them something to think about, something else to think about.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it really is true. When we end conflict in our minds, we can end conflict around us.
Mm-hmm.
And if enough people do it, then a lot of conflict's going to come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Just simply being at peace,
mm-hmm.
and not fighting back at things, or
exactly.
wanting people to be different than they are, because most people can't, because of what we know. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Ron, good to see you.
Good to be here. It's odd that this comes up. When you're around conflict and You're not participating in the conflict. I was recently in a situation where that wasn't appreciated at all, that I was not participating in the conflict. Basically,
yeah.
I was told I had already checked out.
Yeah, what's the matter with you?
Yeah, what's the matter with you? And the only thing I could do at the time was do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right?
The art of war is not to fight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's
yeah,
really
it,
true.
Yeah, people rely on conflict so much,
yeah,
to either to get a point across or to keep themselves established.
Yeah.
It takes a while to get through that attitude. It's conflict. This is the way you deal with it.
Yeah. But common sense would say that if there's conflict, why would me contributing conflict make it go away? It's
mm-hmm.
not, you know, it's just,
oh, yeah.
But that's what we do. The more conflict, the better. But conflict provides a very useful experience to a mind rooted in ignorance. It provides the perfect distraction to not take things responsibly.
Yeah, no better way to establish this thing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good to see you, Janeth. Hope to see you soon. Jigar,
yeah.
Welcome to our Sangha. What do you, how was your meditation?
It's been very peaceful.
You were able to just stay with it and recognize when you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to your breath.
Yeah.
That's the basic practice, that's it. You know, so it'll only deepen as you continue with. Do you have any questions or comments about tonight's class?
No, it was really peaceful. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm glad you're here. I'll have a couple more words to say to both you and Katie after I hear from Katie.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, welcome to our Sangha.
Yeah.
How was your meditation?
It was good. Yeah, same, peaceful. Went faster than I thought.
Oh, good.
20 minutes sounds like a long time, but I just sort of
settled
awesome.
Into
it. It is, yeah.
it was good, and I enjoyed your talk. I think one of the things that resonates with me is the impermanence thing. If you, I don't know, looking at everything in the context of it's impermanent,
yep,
kind of changes your whole view.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that's one thing I'm kind of sticking with right now.
Yeah, good. That's a primary. It's good that you're drawn to it, because that really is the essence of all of this. That all things are impermanent,
mm-hmm,
and if things are impermanent, they can't be me.
Right.
As far as meditation, if you're comfortable with 20 minutes, that's fine. But what I always suggest, not often, is when you're just starting out of practice, start with short periods of meditation. Consistency is much more important than length of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Always, not just in the beginning.
Right.
So on the website, there's some recorded guided meditations like we just did tonight from 5 to 45 minutes. So maybe start with 5 minutes. And if you can do that twice a day and then continue to develop your understanding of the broader Dhamma, and you'll have a well-established meditation practice, and you'll develop these, you know, this calm and peaceful mind that we talk about rather quickly, right?
Right.
But really, it doesn't.
Right.
It just takes some application. Very few people can actually do it on their own. The reason I'm saying that is I hope you continue to join us on Tuesdays or Saturdays. And go to the website, becoming-buddha.com, if you haven't already. Start on the page for new visitors. And then also on the homepage, there's a list of suttas in order that they're best read and understood in. So you can start there. And I'm always free, available for any questions you might have, an email or give me a phone call. So glad you both joined us tonight. So, David, good to see you.
Teaching and
I don't have anything else to add. Glad you're here. Bonnie, good evening.
Good evening. It's a good class. I think what Ram was talking about is pretty significant. If sort of being begged in to be participating in conflict or some outrage and not reacting, it's almost, others might see it as you're abandoning them.
Mm.
To not, aren't you outraged? Well, yes or no, but so it's it's a balance. Well, it always is a balancing act to stay in the middle, but
yeah.
I'm grateful for the Eightfold Path and providing the way to be able to find that balance.
Yeah, it is a challenge. Thank you. And
you're
to others who expect you to have the same amount of agitation that they might have, or at least are trying to generate in you, it's difficult for them. But I know that the more that I can maintain a calm and peaceful mind, the more that eventually they can at least have the opportunity to develop that.
Mm-hmm.
And that they might not in the moment, well, you know, that it's not my intention that that's what's occurring. But I know that, like I say so often, the most loving thing I can do for myself and all other human beings is to take to the Dhamma, treat myself gently, and treat others gently. You know, avoid that conflict. It's never helpful. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean it's easy at times,
mm-hmm.
especially with the people that we're closest with, when they're caught up in their own lives and their own views, to remain calm and feel like we're not in there with them. They might take it, but it's the most loving thing we can do. Thank you.
Well,
Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you again. It's simple but not easy.
Yeah. I agree with that, but it's a lot easier than not. I think it's tough to keep that going. Does anybody have any questions about the teacher training? Did you get the? I think you all got the notice to send that. Okay.
I missed it, but I'm going to go back and look. So
okay.
I'm
yeah.
Sure, it's there.
It was in Sunday's email specifically, but it's also linked now in the email.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
I think I mentioned earlier that beginning Saturday and Tuesday, we're starting this 12-week called The Truth of Happiness Dhamma Study based on one of my books. So if you, now's a good time to join our sangha,
yeah,
because
you'll
get
really
that.
Yeah, it's really a good place to start.
Yeah, and I think that's it. Okay, well, and as we always end, where is my, oh.
Are you going to have more books available here?
Yes, there's
there are
a,
books
okay.
in the front.
Okay, all right.
There it is. Yeah, there's some Truth of Happiness books out there, but they're also available on Amazon. Okay, we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. You too, Mary. Peace.
Nightmare.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.